Emerging Opportunities with Gavin Serkin and Simon Rose, the show dedicated to global, emerging and frontier markets.
Welcome to Emerging Opportunities, the only show on your radio dedicated to global emerging markets. I'm Michael Considine, and taking us through the programme is Gavin Serkin, author of Frontier, exploring the top 10 emerging markets of tomorrow, and the managing editor of the Frontier Funds Consultancy. Now, Africa is often cited as the biggest emerging opportunity, quite simply because of the scope for economic regeneration in the poorest continent. So, Gavin took the opportunity of the Super Return Africa Conference in Cape Town to interview five keynote speakers on different aspects of investing and doing business in Africa. He started by focusing on South Africa, which has been engulfed in political and economic controversy for months, and matters appear to only be getting worse, with President Jacob Zuma facing corruption allegations while the country has been downgraded to junk status by credit ratings companies over concerns on economic mismanagement. In the first of his five interviews, Gavin begins by discussing corruption and social concerns with South Africa's former president and Nobel Peace Prize winner, F.W. de Klerk. Gavin asked Mr. de Klerk whether he sees corruption and concerns about poor educational standards being addressed.
The good news is that the government has realized that we need to address these issues, such as corruption, such as the problem of a failing education system, such as our very high unemployment, and that they appointed a commission which resulted in a national development plan being adopted. That national development plan contains proposals which, if implemented effectively and speedily, will be able to address those problems. Corruption is a tremendous problem and lies at the heart of the political debate at the moment. And maybe corruption can only be addressed if we have a change of leadership, which seems to be in the offing. But education, to my mind, lies at the root of our economic problems.
Now, when you talk about a change of leadership, be a bit more specific if you can. How do you see this evolving? Where do you see the ANC going?
I see a new political realignment, more around values and away from old historical divisions. I see the moderates within the ANC and the radicals within the ANC getting separated from each other. The war will be who gets the trade name ANC and who forms a new party. But I see a split coming, whether it will be a series of smaller splits or one big split, I can't predict. But a split coming and a realignment in party politics where people believing in the same values, although they find themselves in different parties, will much more easily be able to work together, form coalitions, and will be representing the overwhelming majority of South Africans, which are moderate in their outlook and who would like South Africa to succeed, and who don't believe and don't support radicalism in whatever form.
Now, we're two decades on from the bold steps you took to eradicate apartheid. Where has South Africa succeeded since then in building a cohesive society, and where are the limitations? Where are the biggest concerns that you have?
We are still a very divided country. The gap between rich and poor has not really been closed. We have extremely high unemployment. The official figure is 27%. But I think for black younger people between, let's say, 18 and 30, it must be about 50%. This is a time bomb on which we are sitting. So we have not succeeded in really bringing bigger cohesion. And many political parties are unfortunately using this to promote their own party particular interests rather than being committed and giving a lead on nation building. So that's a negative. On the positive side, from time to time, when we had the Soccer World Cup here, the whole nation united. We have the capacity to. Everybody respects our new flag. And if you just walk the pavements of the cities of South Africa, you find a warmth and a goodwill which I think is our biggest and greatest asset.
And that division that you talked about has a big influence on investment, because just to take an example, in terms of fiscal cohesiveness within the country, I read somewhere that 13% of the population pay income tax. Just as an example, this is an element that the economy overall needs to address to bring more people formally into the economy.
I'm not so sure about the 13, but it is a very low figure. Mm. But everybody pays VAT. So everybody is contributing in the indirect tax method. Income tax for the higher income groups is not excessively high. It's about 41%. For companies, it's even slightly lower. So at the moment, the thresholds that we have isn't too high. But there is a risk that with government expenditure not being controlled very effectively, with a bloated bureaucracy and civil service, that it may turn out more negatively than I would hope.
And that was F.W. de Klerk, former president of South Africa, speaking in Cape Town with Gavin Serkin. Now, Gavin's interviews continue with another man at the centre of African politics, the UK's former Africa minister, Mark Simmons. Gavin began by asking Mr. Simmons whether he saw progress in efforts towards economic cooperation between countries in Africa.
Well, sadly, we're still some way off the completing the regional integration programme. There has been some progress made, whether it be countries cooperating on roads, power, infrastructure, or oil pipelines, but it needs to go far further. I think part of the debate is whether countries should pool their sovereignty to create supranational organisations, as has happened in the European Union. You won't be surprised to hear me argue that's not a model I think Africa should follow. I think it should be much more about individuals within regions cooperating to stimulate at this stage intra-African free trade and intra-African customs unions to enable the free movement of goods, services and capital.
And those individuals you're thinking are government types, officials, or private sector?
Well, it's a mixture of the two. It's both governments who have to create the architecture under which the private sector will thrive and choose to invest. But there's also a direct link between good governance and creating confidence for investors who then assure that the capital that they invest is going to be secure over time. And there's a direct relationship between those two things. And one of the really encouraging facets that I'm finding as I still travel extensively across this exciting continent is that African governments now get that, and they realise that good governance will mean greater foreign direct investment, greater economic growth and more jobs for their fellow countrymen and women.
Who or where have you been most excited about during the last couple of years in terms of progress towards integration?
Well, it's varied hugely because it's a very difficult question to answer. I think there are very exciting things happening at the moment over in Côte d'Ivoire on the west of Africa, Kenya on the east, but there's no doubt that stable governance in Rwanda is having a very positive impact. The opportunities that exist in Ghana, although we're all waiting to hear for the results of the elections coming up in 10 days' time or so, and also the longer-term opportunities in Nigeria and Tanzania and Mozambique as well.
Let me pick out one of those. What particularly interests you of what's going on in Côte d'Ivoire?
Well, I think it helps at the moment because of the currency challenges that have happened across the continent, that the Francophone African currency is pegged to the euro, so there's currency stability, which is great, making it a very attractive place for funds both from Europe but also from the US to invest. I was there quite recently. There's a business-friendly government that's keen to diversify the economy across a whole range of economic sectors. So I think it's a very exciting place for investors.
And such a turn from where the country was just a few years ago. But what's the biggest concern you've got in terms of integration? Where is it just not really happening?
Well, it's not really happening, I think, because there's too much focus on trying to create regional structures, supra structures, which will drive regional integration. There also isn't, I'm afraid, the implementation of some of those decisions that have been made, whether it be from memorandums of understanding or ministerial protocols when the ministers or indeed heads of state come together in the regional blocks. There also, in my view, needs to be an unravelling of some of this cross-regional membership to enable countries to create focus on where their regions actually are.
And that was Mark Simmons, the former UK Minister for Africa, the second in our five interviews in Cape Town with Gavin Serkin. Gavin's third interview is with Africa Finance Corporation, which is a Nigeria-based multilateral institution focusing mostly on infrastructure. The EFC's head of financial advisory, Ibrahim Sanya, begins by taking us through the makeup of Africa's economies.
So what's happening is today the continent is evolving at two paces. You have a tale of two Africa. You have the commodity countries, which are Nigeria and Angola, that basically, because of commodity, have had a bit of privilege and a bit of laziness in terms of creating the transformation industries, the infrastructure required to get the commodity transformed at home. And on the other side of the pace, you have countries that basically lack commodities. Those are the Rwanda of the world, the Ethiopia. They've been busy for a decade trying to push exports out, trying to transform at home, whether it's tea, coffee, laptops. They just figure out they needed to get dollar, not via oil. So because of that, they have an edge. And today, if you look at the numbers, the GDP, most of the countries like Angola and Nigeria have GDPs flirting with one or a very dismal number. And you have countries like Ethiopia, Rwanda, Cote d'Ivoire, who are basically between 5 and 10.
Ibrahim Sanya at the Africa Finance Corp goes on to tell us about some of the energy deals happening on the continent.
As you can guess, within the infrastructure scope, power is one of the predominant issues of concern. Mm-hmm. The lack of power on the continent is just way too massive. We've taken our portfolio in power, which includes a $900 million project in Ghana and a project in wind in Cape Verde that provides close to 20% of the power in the nation. We consolidate those assets with assets in power that are owned by a South African fund manager called Harriet. And today we basically have consolidated assets in more than six countries, close to 2 gigawatts of power that is going to grow, and that covers over 300 million people population-wide.
And these are people who, until now, have had quite limited access to power, or unreliable, or non-existent.
Yes, exactly. I mean, in most of these countries, you still have the power issue. And what these projects are going to do is increase, in some cases, the capacity by 10% in some of those countries. So still not perfection, because it's coming from a low base in terms of power penetration. But our goal is to work alongside parties in the investment sphere to basically create a bigger dent. Because the issue with power in particular is not necessarily 100 million or 200 million that's going to translate into many megawatts of power. So you need to be very innovative in the way you try to solve the problem.
Well, that was Ibrahim Sanya at the African Finance Corp. After the break, Gavin will be speaking to the founder of a company which provides informal market stallholders, or street traders in Zimbabwe, with a shipping container that they can convert into a shop.
Emerging Opportunities with Gavin Serkin and Simon Rose, the show dedicated to global, emerging and frontier markets.
Welcome back to Emerging Opportunities. My name is Michael Considine. Now, this week, Gavin is speaking to 5 different keynote speakers from the Super Return Africa Conference in Cape Town. Gavin's next interview is with the founder of a quite remarkable company called Imhanya, which means do it quickly, and it provides informal market stallholders, or street traders in Zimbabwe, with a shipping container that they can convert into a shop, as well as enabling access to credit institutions for people who previously could never have had access to any kind of formal financing. The CEO is Keaton Patel.
We figured out that within Africa there was a problem amongst the micro entrepreneur. 75% of Africa's economy is informal, and more than 50% of it is retail. So we have a lot of tomato vendors, or airtime vendors as they're now called, who have no pathways to legislation, no infrastructure, and no access to credit. So we set up a unit that has the ability to provide them all 3 things. We give them a shipping container, which we convert into a retail storefront. We give them access to credit by providing them with working capital. And we collect data on what were thin file clients, We collect trading history so that they can take that data to a bank and get and become credit worthy.
And this is in Zimbabwe specifically where you're doing this, where, you know, that I'm sure people are well aware of the problems of the currency, where you've got, you know, lorry loads of currency that has become very, very devalued. How do you get around that problem in terms of the day-to-day for the kinds of traders that you're talking about?
So our traders have access to bank accounts and have access to mobile wallets, and they're allowed to transact using all forms of financial instruments. They can transact using mobile money, they can transact using credit cards and debit cards, and they can transact using physical cash in 8 different currencies. So our systems are set up for vendors to take all sorts of financial instruments as payment, but they can also barter. Because we have data, the trader can barter tomatoes for onions or tomatoes for other products.
Okay, and Zimbabwe is a place where the domestic currency has been replaced by lots of other foreign currencies, particularly the US dollar, to some extent the rand, and that's in the sense of transition right now, where it's going to this bond, the bond currency. How does that affect what you're doing?
Well, it's actually improved our business, because there have been cash shortages. So citizens are queuing up outside ATMs, sometimes overnight, to get a limited amount of cash. And we've now transformed the informal sector, where they can now use plastic. So they don't need to stand in line to withdraw the limited amount of cash that they can get from an ATM. And they can now use their accounts to transact account to account, or use plastic from a street vendor, which is quite revolutionary.
Okay, and I take it from what you're saying, you've got some government cooperation here, because you are paying tax on behalf of the informal trader to make them legitimate. How has the relations been there?
It took us a year out of the 2 years that we've been operational to negotiate with government and local councils to collect a $1 trading license to keep these businesses legitimate. And we've negotiated with Ministry of Finance to pay a presumptive tax on the informal street trader. So the informal trader now pays 25 cents a day, which they weren't paying before, and they've now legitimized themselves with not only a bank account, but a legal street trading license, and they pay taxes.
And they sell those bank accounts. So the tomato seller has suddenly become an agent for financial institutions in Zimbabwe.
Yes, the tomato vendor can now open a plethora of accounts for you, or you can choose between 5 different banks to open a bank account using the tomato vendor, who's now an agency banker.
Gavin's final interview takes a very different slant in doing business in Africa, as he meets Professor Dan Ariel, the co-founder of a company called Irrational Innovations. Professor Dan is also a behavioral economist. Gavin began by asking him what this means.
The best way to think about behavioral economics is in contrast with standard economics. So in standard economics, we say that people are perfectly rational, people always make the right decision, think about the future, and so on. Behavioral economics, we don't make assumptions. Instead, we put people in different situations, we see how they behave. And when you look at how people behave, you don't get rational answers. You get people who don't save, and they overeat, and text and drive, and have unprotected sex, and don't take the medication on time, and so on and so forth. And once you understand that human nature is different than perfect rationality, you actually go ahead and create different mechanisms. So for example, what kind of credit tools and spending tools would you give people who are perfectly rational? And what kind of credit and spending tools would you give to people who are basically being tempted all the time with other behaviors? They're very, very different. So it's not just about that humans are different in our view in economics and behavioral economics. It's that the kind of tools that we need to create, the kind of technology that is so important, is very different.
Okay, we're here in Africa, and I know you've done a few different experiments in Africa. Yeah. There's one that you've been doing with M-Pesa in Kenya. Tell us about that.
So in that experiment, we were trying to get very poor people to save a bit of money. And we tried lots of different approaches, because we also say, hey, we don't know, let's just try different approaches. And what we found was that creating a physical reminder at the home was much, much more effective than giving people a 20% match. 20% match, that's a big deal. But what happened was that we created a physical coin, and that basically reminded people from time to time about saving. So imagine you have like a universe of things you can consider. Are you thinking about all of them? No, you're thinking about a small part of it. How do you get people to actually consider other options as well? You know, this idea actually came to me when I was in Soweto. And I saw a father buying funeral insurance for a week. He didn't have much money. And he took the certificate in a very ceremonious way, gave it to his son. And I thought to myself, he was a father that the visible thing he was doing was to take food away from the table. Usually he was taking his income and bringing food to the table and water and whatever it is. Now he was taking some of that income, diverting it to insurance, right? Effectively, the family would see less money coming in. But he did something to show that he was actually doing his job as a parent and so on. And I thought it's a beautiful thing to think about, how do we make the non-visible visible? How do we take things like saving and insurance and making them appreciative, people appreciating them in the family and visible? And that actually now has all kinds of other approaches we're trying to take.
Okay, and one characteristic of Africa, keeping in mind the insurance savings that you're talking about, is that most of African populations are disenfranchised from formal financial services. What's the different mechanism that you apply to Africa compared to the rest of the world?
Yeah, so first of all, there are mechanisms that are important for the poor everywhere. And a lot of it is about overcoming temptation. So if you had a saving wallet, it was in the front pocket of your trousers, you're going to spend it. But if you had some saving wallet that had a little bit of friction, it was a little farther away, it was a little more difficult to take, it helps the poor everywhere. In terms of Africa, because there are no financial institutions, formalized financial institutions, there are all kinds of cultural mechanisms, harambees, or you know, the saving groups. And we've been looking at those and trying to figure out not how do you come up with a technology that assumes that none of those things exist, but how do you come up with technology that builds on those cultural building blocks. So for example, again in Kenya, if you go to the hospital and you find out you have a big bill, you create a group on WhatsApp and you ask people for money. It's actually interesting because the first person who gives you from that group establishes the norm for how much it's okay to give. So you don't want to ask cheapskates because you want, or at least you don't want the cheapskate to answer quickly. You want the cheapskate to answer late, but you want the generous people to answer first. Now, that's a mechanism that is very intricate. Remittances within the country, across the country. These are all kind of mechanisms that have been developed. And when we come to Africa to create any kind of fintech, we can't ignore those mechanisms. Coming up with here is something that works in the US or in Europe and so on, let's just import it here is not the right approach. We do need to understand all the mechanisms that have kind of bubbled up because of the lack of formal institutions and try to figure out how do we empower them in a better way.
Well, our thanks to all of our guests in this special focus on Africa, F.W. de Klerk, South Africa's former president, Mark Simmons, the former UK Minister for Africa, Ibrahim Sanya at the Africa Finance Corps, Keaton Patel, founder of the highly creative shipping crates business Imhanya, and Professor Dan Ariel of Irrational Innovations, as well as to the Super Return Africa Conference in Cape Town for facilitating these interviews, and of course to Gavin Serkin for all of his very probing questions. You can find out more details about our guests and the topics discussed on our Twitter feed at Emerging Ops, along with the full podcast of this show. To catch up on our previous shows, simply download the Audioboom app and search for Emerging Opportunities, or you can go online to shareradio.co.uk or frontierfunds.org. Thanks for listening.
Emerging Opportunities with Gavin Serkin and Simon Rose, the show dedicated to global, emerging and frontier markets.